The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Yes, gives me great pleasure to welcome Don Baker to the show, the blues musician and the actor, I should say as well, because Don, I know for lots of people, it is the music and it's the harmonica and everything, and we'll talk about that. But I'm of an age where you were introduced to me, not through music, but through film and In the Name of the Father. So, you know, you're Don Baker, the actor, to me.
Yeah, that was like, I mean, it's really crazy because like back then, I just thought I was doing Jim Sheridan a favour. And honestly, I remember when we went to the Oscars, a Japanese couple came up to me and asked me for my autograph. And I said, no, I'm not an actor. I was just doing a favour. And he said, ha-ha, Irish joke.
Really?
You know, yeah, so I signed it for them anyway. I mean, yeah, that unfolded like that. Jim and Daniel used to come to my gigs. Daniel A. Lewis loves the harmonica, he loves the blues, and he's a big blues fan. So he was into what I was doing on stage. And so that's kind of how it came about. I always felt they looked at me through the lens of a camera. And they kept saying to me, you need to do a screen test. And I just totally ignored them. Then one day I got a call from my manager, Barry Gaster, who's still my manager today, great guy. And he said, you've got to go over to Kilmainham Hospital. They're running some kind of auditions and Jim Sheridan wants to see you for some role. And I thought, oh, here we go, head shaved, playing the harmonica. And he told me it was about a prison thing. That's all I knew about.
Yeah.
So I thought it was like playing the harmonica in a prison cell, head shaved, you know. And so I go over and he says, we'll read this script. I read a couple of books a week. Like, you know, I'm very literate. So, but the script I'd never seen before. I never seen a script in my life. So like I'm reading like a kid, you know.
Yeah.
Like, did you say, you know, this type of thing? And he said to me, go down to the garden and walk around for an hour or two and learn the script and come back. So I came back and I was still doing the same thing. I went into this room and there's all these people. Daniel A. Lewis was there and he said to me, okay, you know, you're Joe here, blah, 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 deliver the lines there. And I was brutal, absolutely brutal. And he snatched the script from me. He says, improvise. Tell him what you'll do to him if he tells the Brits anything. So I proceeded to grab him by the lapels, spitting in his face. Of course, I'll kill you. I'll kill your mother, your father, you know, and all this. And this went on for a couple of minutes. And I stopped and looked around. And the whole room, all the jaws were open. Just dropping. It was just staring at me. And I said, well, do I get to play the effing harmonica or what? You know, because the penny still didn't drop.
You still thought it was...
Yeah, what's this all about? It was all new to me. And so that's how it unfolded. And then Gabriel Byrne was the producer. He decided he wanted to play the role I was playing. And I had no problem with that at all. Like, I mean, I was kind of scratching my head, wondering, what the hell am I doing here? I'm a musician, you know. And so that was fine with me, and I got talking to Gabriel one day, and the funniest, strangest thing happened to me. It was really weird. Gabriel's talking, we had a mutual friend, Anya Connor, and she had since passed away. She's a lovely woman. And we were talking about Anya and days gone by and stuff. And he left, and when he left, see, he took the role I played. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah,
Karen?
Yeah.
So when he left, I got this thought, you're going to play that role. I got a terrible fright, you know. I mean, in order for me to play that role, he would have to have a heart attack, be hit by a bus.
Yeah.
Or something terrible happened to him. And I went into one of the cells and I swear to God, I got down on my knees and I prayed and said, I do not want that role. But something said to me, you're going to play that role.
Yeah.
So, you know, I got the fright. I said a prayer, I don't want it. And I went home and... Now, I'd been told by Jim that I wasn't playing the role.
Yeah.
So I'm at home, I'm in my tracksuit, and my wife, Jo, at the time, the phone rings and it's Jim Sheridan. And I give her the billy, I'm not here, I'm getting sacked. I knew, you know, because I had a small role down now, you see. So, no, I'm not here. And so, yes, he's here, Jim. I'm like, fuck, you know. So, you know, whoopin', the phone says, Don, yeah, we're over here doing a scene in... Merrion Square, and you've got to get over here right away. How soon can you get here? 20 minutes. And so I drove over, and I mean, I was so green. I mean, I went up, I was in a tracksuit. I said, oh, I never thought to wear clothes. And he said, we have wardrobe done, you know. You know, this sort of stuff. So that scene was actually cut out of the movie, but that's a little bit of how that all that unfolded, you know.
What was it like then doing those scenes with someone like Daniel Day-Lewis?
Well, in all honesty, there's a point in the movie where he turns against me.
Yeah.
And he done that for real. Like, we were the best of mates. We were queuing up every day for a dinner, you know, for cups of coffee, shooting the breeze, and, like, we'd go out together for Chinese meals in the evenings and all that. And all of a sudden, he wouldn't talk to me. I'm scratching my head. What are they doing? I'm like, well, it was the role. He does it for real.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
So, when you were going out for those Chinese meals, because this is the fascinating thing about him, was he kind of... Was he Daniel Day-Lewis or was he Jerry Conlon?
No, he... This is before the film.
Oh, say, before the film, okay.
Yeah.
And then once the film starts...
Yeah, once the film starts, he's still a good mate.
He's still okay with
still
you.
Still in the Jerry Conlon role.
Yeah.
Because up until a point, Jerry Conlon is very friendly with the IRA terrorist.
Yeah.
So,
and it's only when Giuseppe dies that it all kind of turns. Yeah.
All of a sudden, look, he won't even look at me. Won't sit beside me. Won't. And I tell you the truth, I'll be honest about it, like, at the risk of coming across like some kind of wimp, but I felt very hurt. You know, I did, like, because I considered him a friend, and I felt, you know, I wasn't able to separate like he does. I wasn't able to separate my emotions from the character. I wasn't able to do that.
And then when the film is done, does he suddenly just snap back and he's like, God, Don, sorry about that. Obviously, I was playing the role. Or,
no.
You know what happened?
What happened was I went to see him in LA in Bel Air, the hotel he was staying in, just to go and say hello and have a cup of coffee with him. And the vibe was gone, the friendship was gone, everything was gone. So I just got up and I knew. I said, I wish you the best, and I just left.
God, that's an awful pity, isn't it?
It is terrible. And but, you know, it never come back for me.
Yeah.
You know, so, but I still, he's a brilliant human being, he's a brilliant actor. I know, he is a lovely man, and I tell you the truth, the thing we had in common was we're both kind of starting out on the spiritual path. Like, I was reading a book called The Road Less Travelled, and he happened to be reading that as well. And he was going through a tough time, and so was I at the time, you know. And now, fast forward like 40-something years, now I'm reading a book called A Course in Miracles, you know, so I think I've advanced a little bit on my spiritual journey.
Are you a spiritual person?
Yeah, I'm working with this book at the moment. It's called A Course in Miracles. And there's 365 lessons or meditations, one for every day of the year.
Yeah.
And I did that, but I didn't think I'd give it 100%. So this, the second year around on the lessons, I'm up on lesson 227, I think, at the moment.
And what type of lessons are they?
It's spiritual psychology.
Okay.
It helps you shift your perception. You know, our eyes are like film projectors. We project onto the world. You know, so I'm trying to change the real sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, and see things differently. Because there's only two of anything. There's only two emotions, love and fear. You know, and most of my life has been lived through fear. So trying to live through, you know, John Lennon tried to tell us, Mahatma Gandhi tried to tell us, Jesus Christ tried to tell us, like, you know, Buddha tried to tell us, like, the path is true love, you know, but it's a very difficult path.
And are you living your life through love now, would you say?
Well, I try. I wouldn't say I'm very successful, but I give it a shot. I give it a try every day. And the ego is like, I slip back into the ego so easily. You know, it's very hard, like, to, you know, give today over to the Holy Spirit, or give the future over, step back and let him lead the way. And stop thinking that you know, when the truth is, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm willing to learn. I'm willing to.
Is it a religious spirituality?
No, I wouldn't. Subscribe to religion.
You know? Okay.
Religion, you see, you have to be obedient, and religion teaches you what to think, but spirituality teaches you how to think.
Okay.
And that's the fundamental difference, you know. I heard someone say recently, religion is for people who are afraid of going to hell. Spirituality is for people who have already been there.
Yeah. So do you believe in a life after death? Do you believe in a God?
Reincarnation, I keep an open mind on that, you know.
Yeah.
The jury's out on that one. If the gun was put in my head, I'd say yeah. Because, like, when I see six-year-old kids playing Beethoven on the piano, and they've never had a piano lesson in their life, I kind of think, you had to be here before, you can't just... So things like that make me think. And, there's so much you don't know. That's the thing about spirituality. It's like music. The more you learn, the more you realise you don't know.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it's down to fate. You know, and fate. You see, fate is like having money in the bank. You know, you can have all the faith in the world. You can go to the mass like twice a day. You can get confession once a week. You can go to all these rituals, all these things.
Mm.
But it does no good because faith is like, well, as I say, it's like money in the bank. If you don't work with it and use it, it's just no good, you know?
Mm.
And I'll tell you another thing I was really amazed to discover. I never, ever believed there was such a thing as unconditional love. I really didn't because of the Ten Commandments. You know, they'd say to me as a kid, God loves you unconditionally. And I'd say, but that's impossible. There's 10 conditions. And there are 10 conditions that no one has been able to keep, not even Jesus.
Mm.
So, you know, like, what kind of a God is that? But it didn't, like, it was a huge block for me. I couldn't believe in unconditional love. And then I got a book called Conversations with God. And I looked at one of the chapters and it said, I was blown away by this. It said, and God gave Moses 10 commitments.
10 commitments, yeah. As opposed to 10 commandments.
Yeah, so, like, I mean, it was absolutely, whoever changed that word, whenever, you know, however, was a stroke of ingenious, because now they could control the people. Now, all of a sudden, fear was heightened.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, I mean, you know, I'm not here to slag off religion or the Catholic Church. I mean, there's no good to do that. But that, in fact, is what I believe, what happened. And the ten promises, I mean, were the same as the commandments. God promised, when you no longer want to commit adultery, you'll be entering the kingdom of heaven. When you no longer want to hurt another human being, you'll be entering the kingdom of heaven. And I promise you this. These are my promises. I promise you. If you change your thinking like this, you'll be happy and you'll be at peace and you'll be content. But they weren't commandments. You know?
When you, though... And maybe it was a religiosity at the time, but you said, say, during the whole casting for In the Name of the Father, and you said your little prayer, or even today, if you were to say a version of a prayer, I mean, do you ever speak to a higher power? Maybe it's not a God, it's the universe, or it's energy, or what is it?
Yeah, but God is like love. We can't say what it is.
Okay.
We won't be able to say what it isn't, but we can't say what it is.
But there is a greater... There's a greater something out there that you feel in communion with or in communication with.
Yeah, it helps a little bit to understand metaphysics and cosmology. It helps to understand there's only two things. There's left, right, up, down, fat, skinny, big, small, or a variation of. And we don't have any choice in that. It doesn't matter what nationality we are, what colour our skin is, what our beliefs are. We have to live... It's the Alpha and Omega, the yin and the yang. We have to live within these two perimeters. Now, there's only two ways of thinking. You can either think with love or you can think with fear. If you think with love, you will manifest one way. If you think with fear, you will manifest another way. Because thoughts are creative. I'm saying this all very quick because I know we haven't much time. There's nothing you could show me right now that didn't start with someone's thought.
Yeah.
Not a thing. Think about that. Nothing. Anything man-made has to start with a thought.
Yeah.
So thoughts are creative, thoughts are powerful.
And is this how you come to see, you know, your music? Is your music an expression of living through love, or is it something else?
Now, this is going to sound really, really weird.
Okay.
I'll probably regret saying all this later on. But anyway.
That's the fear. Don't listen to the fear. Okay. Don't listen to the fear.
Like, I'm like a messenger boy. Like, I mean, I don't know. It just comes, like playing the harmonica. I get into this zone and I don't know who the hell's playing the harmonica. It just happens. You just get into a zone and it's like being in a trance. And magic things happen. And with the songwriting, I just get a voice for a song. I just go with the flow and it just comes out. You know, But one thing I try to do when I write songs, I try to steer away from intellectualizing. You know, Woody Guthrie, one of my all-time idol songwriters, said any gobshite can get complicated. Takes genius to retain simplicity, you know, which is true, you know.
And has it been ever thus with music? Like, when you started playing the harmonica, was that the sensation that you found yourself lost in it, that it was a trance, that someone took over, that it was transcendent?
No, not at the beginning. That didn't happen until I started playing the blues, until I was about 18. I started playing the harmonica. It was like a mouth organ when I was a child in hospital.
Yeah.
I heard a guy a couple of beds away from me, he had TB at the back area of the spine, maybe. And all he could do was lie on his back, and all he could do was read a book or play harmonica. And so the sound at the time, it probably reflected how I was feeling away from my family.
Yeah.
I mean, I was only 6 or 7, and I was feeling lonely, of course, and maybe fretting from my mother and stuff. And the sound reflected how I felt. So I asked my mother, would you get one for me? A cheap instrument. And she brought one up to me, and I drove everyone nuts. You know, I'd get under the blankets and play it, and he took it off me in the evening, the matron, and I'd be outside her office the next day waiting for it to arrive for work, so I'd get the harmonica back. And those poor men, I must have drove them nuts thinking back on it, you know.
And today then, having played it for so long and having become so proficient and having the reputation you do, you know, Bono talking about you, the best harmonica player in the world, as he said about you, what does it mean to you today? Like, as in, you know, when you started playing the blues, do you still feel the same way today playing the blues as you did the first time you realised you could play blues music? This kid from Dublin.
Yeah, well, it was a slow dawning. It was a slow process, like the harmonica. I mean, you first had to learn all these different techniques. Will I demonstrate?
Yeah,
I
do.
It's not just a question of like taking the harmonica up. First of all, we play in a different key. Like this harmonica is in A flat, so when I play it, I'm going to play in E flat.
Okay.
So, that's A flat, but the style for the blues is like. You know, so it's a different. So you've got to learn, like, I suppose the first thing to learn would be how to play a scale, which is quite difficult. So starting on the first hole, like, so that's quite difficult to do, believe it or not. So
yeah,
it takes a long time to learn how to do that. I mean, from that part is easy, but playing it, that's, you have to bend notes, and if the bend notes, it's quite, if you're not, it's hard to understand. And then you have to learn things like, I suppose, how to play a single note, because everyone would play a, or something like that. So to play, things like that.
Yeah.
Playing with a single note is quite difficult. And then you progress and you learn to do things like bending notes. So I'm bending, it's like a trombone when you pull back the handle, the note bends. And then you learn to do things like rolling, like. And I'm bending the roll. And then stomping.
This is great.
Things like that. Bending the high notes.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them. Wah-wahs. So there's loads of these blues techniques. And then when you learn all those, you can start to improvise and you're probably like. Can do anything you like, you know.
Listen, if you like it, and I know people listening will love it. You're in Westport this Saturday,
yeah,
and then you're down in Clears, great little spot, the theatre at the back of Clears, on the 25th in Kilkenny, and you're off to South Africa then to act in a movie.
yeah, I gave up acting because the last film I did was with Dan Aykroyd and Robbie Coltrane, and we had a scene up in the Dublin Mountains, and the walkie-talkies wouldn't work up there, neither would the mobile phones. So we were stuck up there for 3 days. And, you know, I mean, it was the usual thing, up at 5:30 and make up for 6:15, all the makeup on by 7:15, get a cup of coffee up on the mountains, and we were there all day for 3 days, and it rained, and we just had to sit in the car. All the papers read by 11 o'clock, and I was just bored out of my trainers, oh, I'm not doing this anymore. You know,
so what's tempted you back into it now? Why are you doing that?
The director's a friend of mine.
Okay.
Brett Holliday is his name. He's a South African, and he's always wanted to work with me, and he got in touch, and he has this role for a guy my age, and well, I won't give too much away, but it's a fabulous script.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to doing the role.
Well, as I said right at the outset, despite all your great skills on the harmonica, it's acting is what is how I was first introduced to you. So I'll keep an eye out for Brett Halliday's movie. And like I say, Westport this Saturday and Clears at Kilkenny on the 25th. Don Baker, it has been an absolute pleasure, Don. Thanks a million.
Thank you.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.